Welcome to episode 4 of 3 People 3 Brain Cells, the only podcast hosted by 3 people with a total of 3 brain cells. Today we're going to be talking about fandom with our guest Joyce Liu. Thank you for tuning in, and we hope you enjoy the show.
Hello everyone, and welcome to another episode of 3 People, 3 Brain Cells. I'm your co-host, Jonathan Ma, and as always, I'm joined by our other co-host, Catherine Ma. Today we are joined by a very special and a very wise guest, if I may say so myself, Joyce Liu. So Joyce, if you'd like to go ahead and give us a couple words of introduction.
Hi, I'm Joyce. I'm a classmate of John and Catherine's. I also have a podcast, Midnight at Lampams, which, if I say so myself, was the inspiration for the creation of this one. So I'm like the parent of this podcast.
That's a little arguable.
I will also add that Joyce is Jonathan's debate mentor. So,
Yeah, that's true. She is actually my mentor in debate. Yes. So thank you very much for being with us today, Joyce. You're a true inspiration for a lot of us here. So, today, as you guys probably know from seeing our posts and stuff, we're going to be talking on the topic of fandom. So I will admit, this is an area I'm not that well versed in. You know, I don't have that many personal experiences in fandom. And yeah, I'm just all around a bit uneducated and uncultured about this. So I'm really going to be relying on you two to sort of enlighten me and enlighten our audience about this topic. So as we always do, before we go any further, let's just hear a bit of a quick brief. So what exactly is fandom?
So to me, I define fandom pretty broadly. I think it's just any like subculture or community of people who share an appreciation for a certain like shared cultural touchstone. Could be a political figure, could be books, movies, or even video games. Just you all come together to appreciate something that you all enjoy, and you see fandom with people who like dress up as characters, people who come together to share theories on the next episode of a TV show, or people who write fanfic and draw fan art. It's really diverse.
Yep. So just for some context, fan art, obviously art made by fans, fanfic, fiction, or generally just written works created by fans. There are a few areas where fans can meet, like there are like real life conventions like Comic-Con where you can, you know, sort of dress up, go somewhere, meet creators, talk to other fans. There are other like online communities that are things like Reddit or Tumblr or like maybe even specialized forums where people can just hang out, like Joyce said, share fan art, fanfic, just talk to each other, have a good time.
Cool. So you guys both talked about fanfic and fan art. So what exactly is that like, and do we think that that's good or bad? Because I know that, I mean, even to the uninitiated, I think that there's a bit of a reputation that precedes both of these things, right? So what are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, well, I know fanfic especially gets kind of a stigma attached to it as being like low class or, you know, like very indulgent. But I was introduced to fandom mostly through fanfic as a kid, and I enjoyed it a lot because, you know, you only get like a book a year at the most from most authors,
right?
But you get so much content from the community and you get to explore all kinds of possibilities that canon can't do, because obviously the book can only really take one path, right? But fanfic and fan art explore lots of different versions of the story. And I think I've seen a lot of people who developed as artists or developed as writers by coming through fanfic and fan art as children. So I think it's pretty great on the most part.
Like, for reference, if you guys know Cassandra Clare, that's a very popular YA author, she initially wrote fanfiction. I think she wrote, like, Harry Potter fanfiction before.
Probably. Who didn't?
Oh my god, true. So yeah, I mean, I will admit that I have actually written fanfiction before because I was a fledgling author and I liked writing about the works that I appreciated, so do not ask
me. Yeah,
and
look where she
is
now, you know? Cavern has multiple published stories, so
no,
you know, write fanfic, you'll become
it.
As accomplished.
If you ask me outside of this podcast, I'm going to pretend I don't know what you're talking about.
You'll become as accomplished
really
and successful as Cavern.
Especially, I think that in order to, especially if you're like, you know, younger, or if you're starting out, it's really hard to get your work out there. If you're an artist, right, you don't really know how to get attention. So being able to say, like, publish, you know, something in a community that's already invested in the characters you're drawing or the characters you're writing about, it helps you get traction, it helps you get like feedback, it helps you, I don't know, improve as an artist.
Okay, so one thing that I recently learned exists, and, you know, Joyce, you've already alluded a bit to it this episode, is what you guys have told me is called RPF, or real person fiction. So what exactly is that, and how do we feel about it? Do we think that it's different in certain ways from, like, fandom, or, like, fiction based around fictional characters and fictional sort of stories?
So RPF, I have a bit of experience with it because I've been in, like, sports fandoms and K-pop fandoms, which are obviously all going to be about public figures, right? So I think there's actually a lot of RPF out there that you might be surprised to think about. So, like, even Netflix series like The Crown, or musicals like Hamilton, or novels like Rodham, which came out, it was like Hillary Clinton, but if she hadn't married Bill Clinton. So I think we have a lot of RPF just floating around in the mainstream media as well. Even though it's kind of creepy to me that people are writing about very personal things when it comes to celebrities, I think, on the one hand, as long as you, like, keep it away from them and don't take the fiction into real life, it's mostly harmless. And secondly, most of these people are selling a public persona or a public brand that is not actually who they are. And so in a way, it's basically the same as taking a character, because neither of them are real, per se.
Well, one question I do have for you is, so you mentioned, like, Hamilton, the musical, as an example. Mm-hmm. Do you think that there is a difference between, like, for example, I don't know, we could look at, like, K-pop, or, like, you know, I think you're invested in, like, Formula One, right, Joyce?
Yeah.
Or stuff about, like, current living people and people who, you know, are historical figures, or people who have existed in the past, but, you know, unfortunately, you know, don't live on in modern day era. Do you think that is different, especially, like, if we consider sort of the perspective of the person who is having, you know, these stories, or, like, I don't know, some community, I guess you could frame it as being, like, them being idolized?
Well, I think the difference mostly is that the person you're writing about cannot possibly read what you're writing unless they're, like, a ghost and reading over your shoulder, right? So then there's no risk of you actually intruding into someone's privacy in a way where they feel violated, which is always a good thing, because obviously as a fan, you don't want to hurt someone that you think is really cool or that you want to write about. But other than the fact that they can't see what you're writing, I don't think there's much of a difference. Like, it's just time.
Part of it is that I am a little concerned in terms of, I think you mentioned how it's important to sort of know what is fiction and what is, like, actually, you know, that person. When a lot of people, a lot of fans, and a lot of diehard fans especially, don't really see that separation. Like, kind of, they don't, like, you know, you don't hear K-pop stans being like, oh my god, I really like the character that this, like, this K-pop boy is selling me.
Right,
I really think
he's
well constructed and very appealing. They say, oh my god, he's, like, you know, this or that. I really think that he's, like, a great person. So clearly they do conflate, like, the sort of fantasy with the reality.
Yeah, I think that happens a lot more with fandoms where people are a lot younger. So, like, in K-pop, I think most of the people are teenagers or in their 20s, and especially because a lot of, like, singers and celebrities are selling the fantasy that they're your friend, that you literally do know them through social media or through YouTube or whatever. It's so much easier for the fans to feel like they actually do know that celebrity, and that person is someone that they could meet on the street.
Okay, so can you guys talk a bit about then, like, the specific harms that you think could happen from, like, fans sort of mixing up the real character, so to speak, and the fabricated character, or the you know, the personality that they're playing? Do you think that, you know, do you think that that's a bad thing specifically for the fans to do? Maybe you're saying that it has harmful ramifications for the person who the fandom is around specifically. Could you guys talk a bit about that?
So in One Direction, there was this really popular ship. It was Harry Styles and Lewis, I think. And people, it was called Larry. And the fans would tell the singers. They'd be like, oh, I think you guys are so cute together. I think you guys are dating. And it got to the point where those two people who were in the same band would, like, not make physical contact in public because they were made so uncomfortable by all the shipping that was going on. So I think that's really toxic when you're pushing your fantasy onto these people to the point where they can't be comfortable around each other.
And even on the other side of the spectrum, you see K-pop fans who are like, I don't want my like K-pop star to be dating other people. I think a lot of the contracts are also very restrictive. Like they're not allowed, they don't let certain like K-pop stars date or whatever, mm-hmm. partly to keep up this fantasy that, oh, this is like, you know, your K-pop boy and I don't know, he's dedicated to you. So I do think that is
Joyce is my K-pop boy.
I'm John's K-pop boy.
So John is a fan of Joyce. Interesting.
So Joyce, earlier you mentioned shipping and, you know, you're talking about Larry or Harry Styles. Harry Styles and who's the other guy?
Lewis Tomlinson.
Lewis, okay, yeah. So Lewis and Harry, right? So I think that a lot of people already have some sort of idea of what shipping is. They've probably heard of the term. Like, I know I've definitely heard of the term, even if they aren't really affiliated with or, like, you know, engaged in fandoms. But, you know, can you guys talk a bit specifically about what that is? And then, we can talk about, is that good? Is this kind of like an invasion of privacy, like Joyce kind of talked about, or like what else?
Okay, so basically shipping is a short form of like relationship. You know, your favorite ship is your favorite romantic pairing of potential characters, or I guess real life people as well. So for example, a possible ship from Harry Potter might be like Hermione x Harry, right? A lot of fanfic and a lot of fandom is very like obsessed with sort of these specific pairings, and if you go on like a lot of fanfic platforms, so there's stuff like Wattpad, is it fanfics.net, something like that?
Fanfiction.net, that's where I started.
And then there's AO3, among other platforms, also Tumblr, I think, to some extent, you'll find a lot of like pairings. So, you know, most of the fanfics are going to be like someone X someone else. I mean, initially I thought it was kind of like reductive, because I was like, well, I just want to read my like Harry Potter fiction. Why is everyone like shipping everyone? It's all romantic. But to some extent, I don't know, I guess it's people are very clearly passionate about that, and I do think that there like are some pretty good works out there with these pairings. So I don't know, I'm mostly ambivalent about it now.
Well, I read a lot of shipping content, I guess mostly because that's all there is, but I think it provides a built-in conflict and plot for you. And it's something that it's very easy for you to get excited about. So I think like that's what draws me into a lot of fanfics, as opposed to just the like the plot summary, which usually isn't very good. So if I really like that ship, I'll be more willing to give it a chance. And I think fandom, because a lot of media things, you get two characters together and then there's always going to be people who liked a different romantic possibility more. So those people are unhappy and they write their own content for that ship.
Yeah, it's almost like an inherent source of like conflict, or source of plot, is it?
I'll also add that if the characters do have good chemistry on whatever like show, book, or whatever, then it oftentimes fans are really good at translating that on paper, so it actually does sort of boost the work a little bit.
Okay, so moving on, one thing that I have heard from, well, you, Catherine, is the fact that there are a lot of queer ships.
Mm-hmm.
You know, let's discuss this. Like, firstly, why exactly do we think that this is the case?
Okay, I'm going to actually quickly add some clarifications here, because I think it's pretty useful to know. So by queer ships, mostly in fandom, it's MM ships. That's like male-male ships. So you don't really see very much FF shipping, which is kind of sad, but you know, that's the way it works, I guess. I think in terms of like the actual demographics of fanfic writers, they tend to be prominently female, but that doesn't necessarily mean they're also really straight. I watched a Sarah Zed video that like kind of analyzes stuff, and she mentioned that actually a large portion of fanfic writers tend to be like queer as well. So like bisexual and pansexual mainly, but you also have some like gay women who are writing fanfic. So it's interesting to see like kind of diversity within it. So it's not all just straight women.
Yeah, so I think one aspect of why there are so many queer ships is because fanfic likes to write where the actual popular media doesn't go. So usually in canon, you're not going to get that many queer ships, or you might have two male best friends who stay best friends forever. And then in fandom, you're like, well, actually, those two boys would be great as boyfriends. And so you get a lot of fanfic about that, just because canon doesn't go there, so we fill that gap. And then as for the demographics, I agree anecdotally that mostly I see like queer women writing gay men in a relationship or straight women writing gay men in a relationship for the most part. And so I've heard some concerns from people that it's like a way for straight women to fetishize gay men being in love and having a relationship together. But I've also heard, on the other hand, that fandom is like writing better representation than they can get in the media. But also of like unconventional relationships. Like I see way more polyamorous stuff in fanfic than I would ever see in the mainstream media. So I think there's a degree of fetishization and a degree of like diversity and representation.
I would say they're like pretty distinctly different classes because I do see like if you're reading some fics, it's like they're weirdly fixated on like just adding as many like let's say
Lewd parts.
adult scenes as possible and sort of like they're very fixated on specifically like wow they're gay wow that's a big conflict. Well, I mean I guess the gay angst angle can be done well. I just think that sometimes it seems a little weirdly exploitative. But on the other hand, I've also read a lot of like very interesting fic that like does look at like queer issues from a very like, I think in my opinion a pretty like interesting angle. I've also read lots of like sort of I've read things about like for example ace characters or like sorry headcanon ace characters. I've read stuff about like trans characters and I'm like I don't see this stuff in a lot of the mainstream media I've consumed. So that's really cool.
Even just kind of sort of talking to some people who are really big fans of series or who are, like K-pop stans or stuff like that, right? I feel like you do hear like a lot, like Joyce was actually talking about with the Mr. Lewis and Mr. Harry, right? The sort of like, oh my God, these two are so cute together. Like I feel like I hear that a lot and a lot about K-pop from not well people I know, I won't say friends, but people I know who are K-pop fans. And well, so going back to that then, do you guys think that as a whole, so I think you guys have both like clearly shown that there is sort of, it's not that there it's not that black and white. There is some sort of fuzziness. There is good representation in some works. There's also, blatant fetishization and, reductive exploitation on some sides. So as a whole for the community, do you think that there's one side that it leans more so towards then?
I think it depends on what fandom you're in. So this goes for writing quality too, but just if you tend towards a younger fandom, or I guess a straighter fandom in this case, you're going to have a lot more like weird fics or fics that you don't think are that good or that are kind of problematic. Whereas if you go towards a fandom that has a lot more like queer women writing it, like She-Ra, that's going to have, and they're older too, they're like adults, you're probably going to have better fics as a whole.
I just realized that you guys talked about people becoming authors from fanfic, and even talk about the best book, 50 Shades of Grey.
I've
Actually,
never read it.
one of my
Oh,
favorite written works. It's
I watched a video that was talking about it. I have like a morbid fascination with it because the prose is so awful that it just goes into funny.
I told Catherine this, but I actually had no clue that it was like originally it's Twilight or
Oh
was it
yeah, it's
Eternal?
Twilight.
Twilight,
It's
right?
Twilight
It was
fanfic.
Twilight fan fiction, but then it, like the names got changed for it to be like released as its own thing, right?
But have you read
So
Twilight, John?
I have not. I've not
I
read
have
like
read
any
Twilight,
book.
actually.
Same. It was.
The first and last book I've ever read is Zorba the Greek. It took all the energy away from me. I never want to read text again in my
Oh my
life.
God. I don't know. I would say that Twilight is better than 50 Shades of Grey. I'm sorry. I don't even think it's a contest. That's not saying Twilight is good necessarily, but it's just better.
Right. Okay. Well, that's
Okay, wait.
an
Hot. That's
entertaining
hot take.
tangent.
That's the hot take of the day.
So I think it's also worth saying that just quickly going into that idea of like turning fanfic into actual like published material, I don't think it's a good idea. That's because usually part of what makes fanfic so good is that you're already building upon like pre-existing stuff. So if you're writing like say
Right.
like a Harry Potter fanfic, it's building upon the pre-existing conflicts and the pre-existing themes and like the pre-existing chemistry, and that's why you tend to have like you skimp on actual characterization and you tend to skimp on world building just because it's already there. So when you have to translate it into like a real work and divorce it from the fandom, it just usually ends up being very lacking.
Even if you quote unquote file off the serial numbers, which is what they call it when you turn a fic into an actual book, I feel like it's just very obvious to most people that it's not like a fully realized story, and you just sort of borrowed some characters, like with what's it called? After,
Oh,
the
yeah.
Harry Styles self-insert fanfic. It's that got turned into a book and a movie. Like, that feels very obviously like it's still based on Harry Styles.
Cool. So, moving off the topic of shipping now, I'll talk a little bit more about fan communities themselves. So, I think you can see that there are a whole bunch of positives to fan communities, stuff like support, right? Like getting to meet lots of like-minded people who also might be enthusiastic about something that everyone else will judge you for. Like, maybe they'll think you're too dorky. I don't even know. Or it's also sort of, a cool way to get no well known as an artist. It's a cool way to find representation. If you're maybe a queer person, it's nice to like maybe be able to see other queer people who are writing fic about people who might be facing struggles that you relate with. But I think the more interesting topic is about toxic fandoms. Sort of discussing how can fandoms get destructive? At what point does the support peter out and it just becomes a really bad fandom?
So before we move on, I think that it is important to sort of talk about what exactly is a toxic fandom and what does it look like, because it's definitely, or toxic fandom or toxic community are definitely terms that are fairly sort of commonplace almost. We can think of like the Rick and Morty community, for example, or fandom, I guess, and a lot of people would label that as toxic. Or another one that jumps to mind is, well, I'd argue Undertale, which is an indie game which had a fairly toxic sort of vocal minority, and that kind of yeeted and tainted and corrupted the entire fandom or community. So, it's a very sort of almost a buzzword, but what exactly does this toxicity look like?
I guess I would take toxic very broadly in that a fandom is a place where people come together to share their appreciation of something. And I feel like a toxic fandom is where any group of people large enough to sort of ruin the fun for everyone else takes on like actively harmful behaviors. So you have people who harass other fans, people who harass the actors or the creators, people who start sending like death threats, or they start acting as gatekeepers where they're like, you're not a real fan because you don't know this specific piece of trivia from 25 years ago when the director was a 3-year-old, that sort of thing. I think that by ruining the enjoyment for everyone else, you sort of corrupt the entire fandom, even if there's not that many of you.
I think it's also worth saying that I'm pretty sure basically every fandom does have like a certain amount of these fans. If it's like big enough, it's going to have some like just toxic people in there. But there are some fandoms that are sort of more notorious for it and others that are less so, or like, they're more like wholesome. But I would say that basically every big fandom has its share of toxic fans.
Yeah, no, I think that's a good definition, Joyce. I think it's very robust. So toxic fandoms, how exactly? So you have talked about the fact that, hey, it just happens if a fandom or any community accumulates like a certain amount of people, like at some point you're just going to have like not very cool, not very chill people coming in, right? That's just like probability or statistics or whatever.
I've
But
tried figuring out what makes a fandom toxic, but at this point, like, I don't think it's necessarily related to the work itself, because I know, like, even the show, like, Steven Universe is just, like, very wholesome and all about, like, love overcoming hatred and all, like, and Undertale, which is also very wholesome, like, love overcoming hatred, don't, like, no violence, pacifism is good, that sort of stuff. They both have, like, pretty toxic fan bases, so I honestly don't know how a work itself might like, trend towards a toxic fan base other than just being really popular.
I think part of it might do with like, I guess, the target audience or like the main group of that fandom. So kind of like Joyce was saying, I think that like younger people oftentimes, like, I don't know, we already talked about the idea that, hey, they might not be able to disassociate, like, say with a person, this character from like the actual person themselves. And I think that a lot of times younger people, not like 8-year-olds, mind you, but like teens, mainly like teenagers is, I guess, what I'm saying. I think that that's like a part, and I think that you can look at that as to why certain sort of celebrities and their fandoms and communities are fairly toxic. Like, for example, you know, I feel like I'm beating a dead horse or whatever the saying is, but like K-pop, oh, right?
Yeah.
I think you can also talk about the fact that like younger people oftentimes, firstly, like they probably don't have, okay, this is a weird thing to say, but like I feel like they have more freedom in their lives to be more invested and to be more passionate about things, whether that be because, you know, they don't have to like financially provide for their own things. I know, like personally, I've been like, hey mom, I really want like X thing, and you know, I don't have to balance that with like, I don't know, getting food on the table, paying, you know, rent, paying my taxes, stuff like that. And also just, I don't know, I would say generally speaking, not necessarily, but a lot of younger people do have more free time, and oftentimes, you know, they can just generally speaking be more invested and become more passionate about a specific thing. You know, I can say anecdotally for me that's probably true as well.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so I don't know, do you guys think that that's a plausible sort of hypothesis or reason?
I kind of buy that, but also I think really large legacy fandoms, you know, stuff that's been around for a long time, like Star Wars or Ghostbusters, if the new owners of the franchise tries to change it or update it in some way, I think the fans who have been around since the start, who maybe had an emotional attachment to it in childhood, they get really mad, which is what happened with female reboot Ghostbusters and the new trilogy for Star Wars.
Well, the Ghostbusters film was just a bad film.
It was also bad.
If it was bad, I don't think a lot of films are bad, but they don't get the same kind of vitriol that female reboot Ghostbusters got, right?
True.
And like you could say the newest trilogy of Star Wars is bad, but like the amount of backlash it got was like insane, and the amount of racist comments about a lot of the actors of color and was like pretty sketchy as well, and sexist comments, of course, about the is it Daisy Ridley? I think.
She plays Rey.
It was pretty
I think just in general, in general, specifically I guess in this case about fandom, there is, you know, there you have this vision of, hey, like this is the thing that I grew up with, this is the way things should be, kind of like that nostalgic factor almost, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I think that that's also the case for a lot of, so speaking about games, which, you know, I know about, oftentimes when there is like a big change to like a fundamental thing, there is a lot of backlash, even if in the end it is sort of like, you know, universally agreed upon that it's actually a good change for the game or whatever, like years down the line. So for example, in the game I actually talked about last episode, Darkest Dungeon, which I have not played that much because I beat the game and I don't want to go through the pain of starting a new run because it's scary and it's hard. But there was a specific mechanic that was introduced, which was basically before, there's like, the way the game works is there's like positions, there's position 1, 2, 3, and 4. And before, when you killed someone, everyone just shifted up a position. So the person, the enemy in position 2 would go to 1, 3 to 2, 4 to 3. But now what they did is they added a mechanic that drops corpses and that takes up the space before, so you have to kill it. And the reason why that's significant is because certain abilities and attacks can only target a certain position. So for example, there is a attack on, you know, there's a certain attack that does a lot of damage, but it can only hit the first person in their position. And before, what you could basically do is just constantly, you know, use that attack because they'd all be funneled onto that position. But now this corpse mechanic is, okay, I'm getting nerdy and I'm talking about the mechanics of the game.
Fandom,
basically, the
disgusting.
Point is,
how could you be talking about this?
Basically, the point is, a lot of people really didn't like the change, and there was huge backlash. Like, it's really weird the extent of the backlash. Like, I'm pretty sure the developers of the game even got like some death threats, which is pretty crazy. So what they ended up doing is they did cave in and they did make it so there was a feature where you could switch it on and off. But the thing is, like a year later or whatever, at the end of the day, they did like the statistics from Steam and stuff, and they found that only like 4% of players even played without corpses. So clearly there, it was less so, hey, this is actually something that's mechanically bad for the game, because I played the game and I think that they make combat a lot more interesting. But it's, hey, like, this is our you know, memory, or this is our version of the game that we really like, and you're, like, sullying that, or you're damaging that.
Yeah, yeah. Especially, I think it's worth mentioning how oftentimes I find that this kind of backlash is especially pushed towards, like, whenever someone tries to diversify a franchise. Like, we saw in Star Wars, I think that, or, like, a lot of, like, the more diverse reboots, if you guys know about, like, the She-Ra reboot, which initially got a lot of, like, backlash from, I guess, like, as far as I can tell, like, a lot of, like, sort of, YouTube commentators made videos about it just saying it was, like, bad because they got, like, before it had even aired, because it looked, like, too diverse. Wow, some of the characters are fat now. So, there definitely, I feel like, is a certain amount of, like, this feeling like, oh, maybe, especially if you're in a very male fandom with, like, Ghostbusters, right, where you're like, oh, I don't like that there are these new people who are, like, intruding this fandom. I don't like that, oh, now there's the first, like, female lead in Star Wars, or in a main, like, Star Wars movie.
I mean, I would agree, but I also think that it is sort of important to recognize to what extent that is because of reasons like that, which, again, I do definitely think, do agree, especially, wait, what? Do exist? Especially, like you said, in, you know, maybe a male-dominated community or fandom. But I think that it is also very important to not just, you know, throw aside sort of critiques and stuff as bad, as being based upon, like, xenophobia or, like, you know, hatred or bigotry, and not because of general sorts of criticism. Like, I heard the Charlie's Angels director, this quote could have been taken out of context. I don't think it was. I saw the tweet that was made that this was quoted. She had said, hey, it's not a bad film, it's a great film, it's just men don't want to see, like, this feminist piece empowering women. So, you know, I think the same thing could hold true for a lot of the other things you said. Ghostbusters, the remake, was an incredibly awful film. And, you, for example, Star Wars, I did like the first film of the new trilogy, but, like, especially the last one. I don't really remember the second last one.
The last one was the worst example of retconning for fan service. I have my own opinion. Yikes. We'll talk about that later. I kind of want to discuss that later.
But I again, I don't think that your claims are unjustified. Mm-hmm. I just think that there is a sort of territory that you have to be careful with before you're just, like, dismissing everything, you know what I mean?
I think we can move on a little bit more to sort of the interaction between fans and creators. We've talked a lot about how maybe fandoms might be destructive to their creators, or they might be destructive to each other. But what about, like, when fandom maybe has their own, like, ideas and they're going to be respectful? Maybe they want a ship to become canon, which, by the way, means, like, they want the ship to become confirmed in the show. And they're going to, you know, politely say, hey, these are the reasons why it should be totally canon, or really passionate about this. Please do this, creators. What should creators do?
Well, personally, I think that if it makes sense to include, sort of like, you guys have been dropping these hints the whole time, why aren't these people together, kind of thing, I think it makes sense for creators to sort of take a look at that and say, hey, that does make sense, we could add that into the show. On the other hand, if the characterization, like, absolutely does not allow for that, or it doesn't fit with their overall vision at all, so, like, when people are like, actually, I think Sherlock or Supernatural should have its two main male leads get in a relationship, which is especially weird in Supernatural, then I think it's very valid for a creator to say, you know, this is my show. I know you guys love it a lot, but, like, I had a creative vision when I created it, and that does not work at all with what I want to do. I think you would expect them to respond the same way as if someone called up Supernatural and said, hey, can you make this show about them as space cowboys instead, right? It just doesn't make sense.
My main issue with those two examples is because there's a load of queer baiting in both shows, so I honestly, I'm kind of on
that. That's true. I strongly dislike queer baiting, which happened in The Magicians, where fans called for two best friends to get together, and then they, like, got together, and then they just killed one of them right after.
I can think of some pretty good examples, though, that maybe, I can't confirm that they took inspiration from fans, but I'm pretty sure they did. So, they're both kids' shows, though. You guys know Legend of Korra, which is, like, the sequel of the Avatar, like Airbender one, not the blue people one.
Legend of Korra.
Important distinction. So that one was initially the main character, Korra. She has two like conflicting male love interests, but by the end of the show, she ends up with a woman. And part of that was because in the last season, I think there was like a lot of push from fans to sort of have this pairing because they saw a certain amount of chemistry between them. And also there was, what's the other one? Adventure Time, which had like a load of seasons. It's the one with like the Finn and Jake, but there's also a character called Princess Bubblegum. There's another character called Marceline the Vampire Queen, and they get together at the end of the show after like a lot of years of just fan support for the pairing. So I think those are pretty good examples of when maybe creators can take inspiration from fans.
Well, I'm gonna talk about sort of the context of this in games, which is a bit different. So when I'm talking about like fan push for a certain thing to be implemented in the game, I think sometimes it can be narrative. I think that's a lot less often though. But yeah, I think that oftentimes when we're talking about like fans in games, game communities pushing for a certain change, it's often mechanical. So that means it's changing the actual way the game works. So for example, I already talked about Darkest Dungeon and how there's a lot of fan push for that to work. Another big example is a game called, well, I guess a franchise called Dark Souls, and well, Souls-like games, so like Bloodborne as well. And these are games that are basically infamous and very well known for their very brutal difficulty and how challenging they are. So the games are very difficult. Oftentimes, if you make one mistake, you will just die. And yeah, the game, you know, it's very hard, and it's meant to be that hard, and it plays into a lot of the themes of the lore and of the atmosphere of the actual game, which is very, very dark. It's very, very grim. I just hit my desk. It's very sort of depressing, and you know, it's just awful, and it should feel like that. So in that way, a lot of the mechanics of a game are sort of also artistic expression. So what I'm saying is there has been a lot of push from individuals in communities to implement like an easier difficulty in, say, Dark Souls, or like, you know, there's just a lot of examples. That's a big example I can think of, but oftentimes there will be people saying, hey, this is a mechanic that should be changed. And in that way, I think that it is pretty distinct from, for example, well, yeah, no, it goes along with what Joyce was saying, where it's sort of the idea that if this were to actually change, I think that that is a distinct step away from the sort of artistic vision of the director of the game or of the studio of the game. So yeah, I'm not personally a big fan of that. I think that a game should be able to be, I don't think that games should be made to be accessible for all people in terms of difficulty, and I don't think that developers should necessarily have to listen. Obviously, that's different if, like, there's an incredibly bad game, and then there are, like, really big problems, like, glaring problems with the game. And I know that there have been a lot of instances, not only in game, but also, like, I know this is definitely true for, like, film and film criticism, where it's just sort of portrayed as, oh, hey, they're the haters, like, hey, you know, it's just, like, my artistic vision, when something is, like, inherently just a bad design choice. And I think that, you know, it's important to differentiate that then.
I don't know. I'm kind of conflicted about this mainly just because as a creator, I also understand that, like, when I give someone something to, like, one of my works to read, I usually take their advice pretty seriously because it's like, hey, you don't always know best. And sometimes your artistic vision just kind of sucks. Okay. Last topic. Quickly, we talked about how, you know, creators should deal with fandom, but now let's talk about how fandom should deal with their creators. What if your creator is kind of sketchy? I think we know this example most prominently, recently at least, in J.K. Rowling, who's had some pretty transphobic stuff, which honestly did disillusion a lot of her longtime fans. We also see this in people like Orson Scott Card, who was pretty homophobic, or H.P. Lovecraft, who was just, like, really, really racist. So what do you do if you're a fan of the work, or if you're part of the fandom, and your creator just happens to not be a very good person?
So I think when I've encountered problematic creators that have created works that I really, really enjoy, for example, Harry Potter, I take the same approach that a lot of Harry Potter fans have taken, which is the author is dead. Quite literally, sometimes people like to joke that they don't know where J.K. Rowling went. And you sort of take this thing that you love and has some very beautiful themes, especially in Harry Potter, about like found family and love and how it like triumphs over hatred, you know, for children. And you just sort of say, well, we're going to ignore that this person is so terrible and we're not going to like give her any money or support her by going to new movies and paying for it. So people will pirate the movies or they'll get the book from the library instead of buying their own copy, where they're like, this is a really great work, but this person really sucks. So I'm just going to avoid giving them any financial benefit as much as possible, which is what I do with like Woody Allen movies or anything like that. I just pirate it.
Okay, my main issue is I'm not even sure if it's possible to divorce works from their creators. Like, if, I mean, obviously, firstly, they're like, the works are their brain babies, right? Like, there's that fact. Not only that, I think there are very clearly sometimes you can see their perspective go in their work. Like, H.P. Lovecraft, a lot of his monsters are just, like, low-key metaphors for immigrants. Or, like, J.K. Rowling, you can see some of her perspective on the fact that, like, hey, all like basically all our characters are white and all the characters that are non-white have dumb names like Cho Chang. Not only that, but if you're going to do something like still support the work by like writing fanfic, or if you're going to still support it by like, you know, talking about it, you are still kind of, you know, spreading this work and spreading love of this work, which could still, you know, contribute to overall people buying it or people supporting the author.
That's true. I also think that there's a difference with the way most people treat Harry Potter, because like you grew up with it and you love it so much, versus the newest novel that J.K. Rowling released, which is like this guy dresses up as a woman and invades women's bathrooms to kill them, which is very clearly, which is very clearly her projecting like her ideas of trans women as predators, which is something she's talked about extensively on Twitter, into an entire novel. I feel like most people would not buy that if they know about it.
One thing I will say, though, is I think that even outside of the context of this, even just as a fan who is reading something and might not necessarily like, or even if it's like there is something that isn't conclusive in the show, so for example, there's a cliffhanger, or for example, like you guys were saying, there's like an ambiguous relationship, but they have some level of charisma, I think to that extent, you, in a fandom, when you are doing stuff like shipping and stuff, you are already saying, oh no, like,
the author
I am
dead.
Taking the reins, you know, I am creating this, I believe the term is headcanon, Catherine, I think that you've used,
yes,
where it's sort of like, hey, I really don't care, this is the way it is in my head, and that is just the way it's going to be for me. So I don't, you know, I think that, yeah, you can say that, like, if you are interpreting the work as the author meant for it to be interpreted, I feel like I am mispronouncing that word every time, but then yeah, it's very difficult to actually disassociate sort of, you know, like you said, the sort of I don't know, in Harry Potter, Catherine, I think you told me that like there's something that's like homophobic or something like that.
I have opinions about their representation of gay people, and also I have opinions about lycanthropy, which is like the werewolf disease. I just think it's like, because Rowling said something about it being like a metaphor for like HIV or something like that, and I was like, no, it's the worst metaphor for HIV.
Yeah, but my point is, I think that already to some extent people do that, and I you know, I think that it goes to the discussion of should artists have the, like, should their interpretations of their own work sort of be more applicable than anyone else's interpretations? Obviously, that's arguably more pertinent in stuff like very abstract high art that's just, like, kind of confusing and avant-garde for me to look at. But, yeah, so, like, you know, the debate motion, do they actually have that sort of privilege, I guess, of interpreting it, or should their interpretation be weighed more?
We're basically done with this like fandom conversation, so we're gonna hop into the questions now. So firstly, to Joyce, why Teen Dynasty harems?
Well, there's this very specific subgenre of Chinese dramas which focus exclusively on like fighting for power within Qing Dynasty harems, and I watched a time travel drama in 2011 with my mom that was really popular at the time, that was about a girl who got thrown back into the Qing Dynasty. And after that, I got like sucked into that very specific niche. So now I've watched a bunch of those dramas. And over time, you pick up just through osmosis, like, what are all the ranks of consorts and concubines, and how many of them are there, and what things are they allowed to put in their hair, and how many servants can they have, you know? So I just know very weird details now.
Another question that's addressed to all of us is, what fandoms have you been a part of, if any?
I'll start first. I have been in a lot of fandoms, especially when I was younger. I was a huge fan of, if you guys know the sort of the middle grade series Wings of Fire, it's like a lot of dragons, but also like questing and like cool prophecy stuff. I also really liked Percy Jackson, Harry Potter, basically everything that was fantasy and everything that involved questing.
Oh, that's cute. I also started with like Harry Potter, Percy Jackson, all the questing, heroes, because that's what kids read. And then middle school, I got into Hamilton, K-pop fandoms. Now I'm in like Formula One and Polygon, which is a YouTube channel and news site.
So for me personally, again, I haven't really been that invested or engaged in any sort of communities or fandoms.
Says the gamer.
That's not to say that I haven't been really like deeply interested in or passionate, I guess, or invested in something. So like I said, last episode with Darkest Dungeon, I played it until like 3 a.m. every night. That happens very often, actually. I recently got into a game called Torchlight 2, which is a very old game, but it was like free, so I got it. And I played the demo as a child, and you know, kind of nostalgic. But anyway, yeah, I've been also playing that really late at night. And yeah, so for example, when I first got into anime, the first show I watched was Fairy Tail, which hindsight 2020, as someone who has more than zero brain cells, you know, one is still bigger than zero, I can say that the show is awful. It is garbage. But like, to me, as a small child, I just found it so cool. Like, you know, you have Natsu Dragneel, this red-haired man who can drink fire. I found that really, really cool. And I would, again, as like a tiny child, or I don't know how old I was, probably like 12 or something, I would stay up until 3 a.m. Just binge-watching the show. And it was like the only thing that was on my mind. I was just constantly thinking about it. I was constantly thinking like, wow, that guy who strips all the time is so cool.
Do you have something you want to tell us?
That's gonna sound weird out of context. But yeah, thing is, I never really engaged in any of these communities. So yeah, in terms of actual fandom, I often talk with like my friends who are interested in the same things. So like, I talk with one of my best friends. I won't say his name, but about anime a lot, and we're both really into anime, and we like a lot of the same shows. And I talk about to a lot of my friends about League. So I guess in that way, you could call it like a micro community or a micro fandom. But I don't really engage in bigger community stuff, mostly because I just find it really tiring.
Okay, last question: how do we deal with toxic fandoms? There are a lot of them. That's the question.
I guess if you're in a toxic fandom, you could pull a Jonathan and sort of stay away from the larger community and find your own micro fandom of people who you sort of get along with and aren't going to yell at you when you have different opinions on ships and stuff, so that you're not interacting with that fandom drama, because it can turn into a dumpster fire really quickly, and it's very taxing on your mental health, I think, to be fighting people all day.
I also think that in some cases, there are specific sort of platforms for certain communities that are better, if that makes sense. So often, like, subreddits will have pretty, like, heavily policed, like, moderation. Often that's the case. That's not always the case, right? But, like, for example, usually speaking, I was actually reading a post on Quora about this, and I was like, don't go on Twitter if you're a K-pop fan, or like, if you don't want to see toxic K-pop fans, go on like the, I think they said like the Tumblr and like Pinterest, which I don't even know you could have a community on. But yeah, it, you know, it makes sense given that like Twitter, it's a lot more of a sort of, I guess, battleground. You can't really, you don't really have that sort of hierarchical chain or like structure of power where, you know, in a subreddit, you have these people are the mods. They make the rules. You have to adhere by the rules or you get kicked out, right? It's just more of like a free-for-all, I guess. So that could also be something that is beneficial.
Yep. Okay, so that should be all the questions we have.
So unfortunately, we couldn't get to all of the questions. Some of the questions we thought were kind of redundant to information we already covered, and some questions we just unfortunately did not have enough time to answer. But we are going to move into the last segment of the show, of course, the media recommendation. So Joyce, what would you like to recommend for us all today?
Well, since I also have a podcast, I have to plug it. Midnight at Lamb Fams. We talk about everything. It's like you're listening to people at a sleepover. Very fun, lots of jokes. But also, one of my favorite artists just released a new album, so I'm going to promote his old albums to celebrate. So you should all listen to Carrie and Lowell by Sufjan Stevens. Very good for doing homework.
So if you want to check out more of Joyce, go check out Midnight at Lamb Fams, LAMFAM apostrophe S, I think.
Yes.
So that's going to do it for today's episode. Thank you so much, all of you guys, for listening.
Please, comment, give us feedback, criticism if you guys want to be on the show, DM us. If you guys have a topic you want us to talk about, DM us.
Thanks so much, guys, and we hope to see you next time.